Fellas, it's good to see you. It's been a long time. Kit, you look amazingly, perfectly, absolutely pixel perfect, which is amazing. I think one time we did an episode and I think your internet cut off. So I feel like this is the long awaited return of Kit Clarenberg. Alexander McKay, you are Alex's episodes. I'm sure if the hardcore East of the Podcast people will remember, Alex comes on to do these episodes regularly when there's more chaos in the UK, political chaos. So we are back once again with the boys. Guys, it's good to see you. I don't think, I'm trying to remember now. I don't think we've done an episode since you guys launched your show. I don't think so. Maybe we've done one. I'm not sure now.
We did a joint episode.
Right, we did one. Okay, good. Yeah, good.
We did one joint episode. I mean, I must say that, like, I mean, it is really offensive that you've had Alex on so much and not me, and I'm going to be writing to but yeah, I mean, and maybe we could title this episode "The Revenge of History," because I mean that's what me not being pixelated amounts to. I think.
I like it. Okay, the revenge of history. That's actually a great theme, because a lot of history has happened in just these last 6 months. But I am guilty of this, of putting the Ukraine war on the back burner, like intellectually. Probably you guys not as much because you're closer to it geographically and also politically. But it feels to me that like the Ukraine war has taken a back seat to the Iran war, insofar as, you know, one has kind of continued and muddled on. And, you know, although there are a lot of things happening right now, which we'll get into, because it's not muddling at all. It's actually like escalating in insane ways. And last night was more. But it but at the same time, you know, these two things are linked. These two wars and are part of a wider crisis of imperialist hegemony. But before we get to that, we do have to start with the UK having yet another prime ministerial crisis. So, Alex, why don't you start, since you're our chief British destroyer of things, the destroyer of British things. You're not British. I meant to say that. But maybe you can explain what happened with the latest prime minister. So are we on, I think this is 8 in how many years? Is this prime minister 8 or prime minister 7? In like 10 years or something? Something is ridiculous?
I think this is number 8 in 10 years. This is a certain Andrew Burnham, who insists that we all call him Andy, who has been brought in to replace the ridiculous strangle voice.
Actually, wait, sorry, Alex, can you check your mic? Because do you have a mic connected? Or is that, it sounds like hollow.
I got the regular mic connected.
Okay, go. Keep going. Sorry. No, that's better. It just felt like you were a little far.
Okay, I'll roll closer to the mic.
Yeah, that's better. Perfect.
The latest incumbent in the palace of sin known as 10 Downing Street is Andy Burnham, of course. He replaced previous occupant Sir Keir Starmer, a man whose entire life had been spent as effectively an asset of the British security services, who was elevated into Parliament following some time as the chief prosecutor in Britain, who made his name really fitting up Julian Assange and covering up establishment paedophile scandals, which is why he was regarded as being suitable prime ministerial material. Unfortunately, for those that made that calculation, Keir Starmer has all the charisma of a block of particularly dry wood, and a voice that sounded like a man undergoing a painful metallic bout of constipation. And this, strangely enough, was not a particularly good selling point to the voting population, nor was the fact that he was seen rightly as being one of the men who had knifed Jeremy Corbyn in the back and had profited from his downfall. And so his first 2 years in office were marked by two things. One was his continued and enthusiastic backing for the Ukraine war, which, of course, he had that in common with all of his predecessors going back to 2022, though in actual fact, all of his predecessors going back to 2014, because that's when the war actually began. So it goes all the way back in British terms to David Cameron. I'm sure Kit will expand on the British role in Ukraine. But so he backs the continuation of the Ukraine war. He also, though less openly, backs continued British involvement in the genocidal actions of the Israeli regime. That's the other side of it. Now, he has to do that a little bit more quietly because of the groundswell of opinion in Britain that's very solidly against the British role in his involvement with the Israeli regime. But he also unleashes a tidal wave of domestic repression against Palestine Action supporters, against people who just turned up with cardboard signs to stand in public squares saying that they opposed the ban on Palestine Action. So now in I've been covering for my own channel like the trials of people in Scotland who have been faced with terrorism charges literally for holding up handwritten signs. That's like Keir Starmer's legacy more than anything else, which is the legacy of domestic repression, something else which he shares in common with all of his predecessors. Now, this combination of domestic repression, open association with a genocide, and like having all the charisma of an empty tin can, and of course his association with celebrity standards as Jimmy Savile, made Keir Starmer very unpopular. And after a disastrous showing in the local elections, the Labour Party panicked and decided to get rid of him. They replaced him with a guy who I've actually met a couple of times in person, which is Andy Burnham, who again is a very long-standing Blair-era cabinet minister who was an enthusiast for the Iraq War 20 years ago, was an enthusiast for the Libya War, the Syria War, just about any war you care to imagine, but who was just about clever enough to get out of Parliament in the Corbyn era and go and become mayor of my home city, Manchester, where he's sort of tried to reinvent himself as a sort of social democratic figure, which, you know, in reality, just operating a gigantic money laundering operation for property developers from Qatar and other like shady Gulf states. Though, and then he reinvents himself again as the great hope of the reborn Labour Party. So they bring him in. And what are the first things that he does? Commits again to the Ukraine war, because, again, no British prime minister really has a choice about that. The assault on Russia, the attempt to collapse the Russian state, that's a strategic priority for British imperialism. So you do not get a choice. If you are prime minister of this like fading, flailing and decaying imperium, that's handed to you on day one as this is your agenda. He's also been more enthusiastic publicly than Keir Starmer was in terms of providing British support to the US for bombing raids on Iran. Now, Starmer was doing that anyway, but Burnham has been slightly more open about the fact that it's not that they're not just using British bases for defensive operations anymore. It's like they're openly just allowing the US to do anything, whatever the hell they like from the British bases, which was always the case. It's just that now he's being more open about it. So essentially, like, what you've got is a change in mood music. Burnham's going around talking to all the people who might have been considered voting for the Green Party or voting for other left alternatives and assuring them that he's bringing back the classic Labour Party, that they can vote Labour again because, you know, he did this ridiculous non-apology for Starmer's association with the Gaza genocide, saying, oh, well, you know, maybe that didn't come across too well. Basically, he just restated the long-standing British Foreign Commonwealth Office position, which is that they support a two-state solution, and some of these Israeli settlers, they're a bit mean, and that Ben Gavir guy, he's a bit nuts. But basically, the policy remains the same. It just now it comes with better PR and better spin. So Burnham, I predict, will be in crisis within 18 months to 2 years because the British economy is completely dead. It's completely flatlining. The British capitalist class won't invest because the profits for investing in Britain itself are too low. He continues to support militarism and armed intervention in Ukraine. He continues to back the war in Iran. He continues to back the Gaza genocide. This change in the mood music will not wash because everyone's going to realize that it's the same shit, just be delivered in a different package, this time with a friendly northern accent. And, you know, he likes to make references to the Smiths and Oasis, which I don't see how God. That improves
things. Are you
things.
Serious? Oh, that's no. Wearing a hat backwards and riding a skateboard. No.
Yeah. Oh, no. Before this year is out, he'll be coming on stage dancing to like the Happy Mondays and the Stone Roses. And he'll be like, saying, hey, you know what I say about foreign affairs? You got to roll with it if you want some morning glory. And the Guardian writers will all just wet themselves with glee, you know? Oh, God. I completely forgot about the genocide because he referenced a song from 1995. That's the only standard that's applied here. So the crisis will return. The long-term decline of British imperialism is the reason why we've had 10 of these idiots over the last 10 years. None of them can fix the crisis. None of them will change the fact that the real power in Britain is not operated via 10 Downing Street. It's operated via the military high command, the intelligence services, the Bank of England, the City of London, and the permanent bureaucracy. The Parliament is a joke. No real decisions are made there. Their policy is written, presented to a cabinet of stuffed dummies who say that's a good idea, and in a Parliament of an even greater collection of stuffed dummies say that's a good idea as well. The only thing that will change is there will be more domestic repression. There'll be more attempts to like clamp down on any attempt at political change whatsoever. And all that will happen is they'll end up discrediting the political establishment even more. So roll on the dissolution of the so-called United Kingdom. It can't come soon enough.
Thank you. I was expecting the best, and that's what we got. Thank you. Except we have even better coming up with Kit, because Kit can zoom out for us a little bit, because your beat is more like thinking about how the imperialist British machine functions, or more likely dysfunctions. So I'm curious, what beyond the sort of domestic chaos, the British imperial machine is kind of marching forward, but what are kind of some worrying trends, you would say, from the perspective of, like, say, an arch British imperialist who wants nothing but, like, you know, the Union Jack flying all over Europe? What do you think is happening on the ground with actually British imperial politics? Presumably, you're going to start with Ukraine, because that seems to be. But you tell me. Oh, you're muted. I think you're muted. Sorry.
That's actually a catchphrase on our show. So that was deliberate. It's kind of a callback in joke reference. But in all seriousness, agree with everything Alex so eloquently just said. Is that like, I mean, it, just as a bit of background, like, I mean, spectating from a distance, British politics over like the past 10 years has been pretty extraordinary, because, you know, I was a politics student at college and university, and when you study the British political system, it's rammed into your head that it's a system that ensures stability and, you know, governments that have majorities that with the ability to govern without too much in the way of problems, and this is a supposed strength of the British political system. And then, you know, it's been prime minister after prime minister after prime minister since then, and you know, Keir Starmer was elected with a pretty historic majority in 2024, and he's already left due to an internal party coup, having come in boasting about how he was going to do two terms. So, I mean, you know, everything that it's just a an ample demonstration of how literally everything I was taught at school and college and university is not true. And it gets less true with every passing day, it seems. But yeah, I mean, I think that British imperialism is in a real state of crisis, because for a very long time, I mean, if we go back, say, like 20 years, when, you know, Tony Blair was still to a degree in his element, and there was this, he was pushing this bullshit, you know, cool Britannia, he was at the forefront of, you know, the supposed humanitarian interventions post 9/11, he was pushing for this before 9/11, there was this sense that Britain might be nowhere near as powerful as the US, but it was still, you know, a major player in international affairs, and you know, had the economic and political and military power to enforce that, etc. And you know, this was going to be an ever evolving story. And you know, well, we fast forward to today, and that's, you know, very much not the case. And I mean, there are all manner of different crises within British imperialism. Both close to home in Europe, but also, you know, all over the world. You know, MI6 retains, you know, a significant degree of power and ability to influence events and dictate the composition of governments and government and influence government policy in you know, many in every corner of the world, which, you know, gives Britain an outsized role in global affairs. But at the same time, I mean, you know, things are looking pretty rough, to say the least. Like, I mean, on the Ukraine point, you know, Keir Starmer specifically sought to outflank the already, you know, hardcore Ukraine ultra Boris Johnson led conservatives on Ukraine, and was, you know, calling for constant escalation and for Britain to give more financially and materially and to support Ukraine's war effort. Starmer comes in July 2024 and said, you know, and one of his first acts is to announce, we're going to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. For the 2 years that he's in office, there's a lot of talk and pledges to commit British forces to Ukraine, but, you know, each and every time this comes to nothing, because it's a total fantasy. You know, Keir Starmer's overarching objective, the reason that he was allowed into Downing Street, was to get Britain into a direct hot war conflict with Russia. He was absolutely not the person to sell this to the British public. Andy Burnham represents a total continuation of Starmer in every meaningful way, particularly in foreign affairs. You know, it must be stressed, this is something that we've discussed on Decline and Fall, it's something that I've written about for The Grey Zone, is Keir Starmer and many other senior figures within Starmer's Labour, who still, in many cases, occupy positions of theoretical power within the British government, people like John Healey, for many years were getting direct briefings on lines to take and policies to adopt on Ukraine from the most deranged elements of the British deep state, in effect, often with our dear friend Paul Mason acting as, you know, a broker between people in power and his pals in the security and intelligence services and the military. This accounts for why Britain is committed to the most deranged, hawkish policies on Ukraine imaginable. And, you know, we are talking about individuals briefing Healey, who resigned because Starmer wasn't spending enough on defence and wasn't preparing for war with Russia sufficiently, and is now Chancellor and therefore in a position to attempt to fund efforts in this direction. They were being advised in 2022, you know, in like April, right when Russia and Ukraine are apparently on the verge of signing a peace deal, but get sabotaged by Boris Johnson. You know, they're being advised, well, you know, we should escalate this further. Ukraine can win this if only we give them the right amount of support, if only we really get behind the idea of crushing Russia in this. You know, the same information, expert sources were briefing the Labour front bench on the prospects of nuclear war, saying, well, it's actually not that much of a big deal and we shouldn't really worry about it. And being told, well, if you give Ukraine these long-range missiles, which can strike Moscow, us go, well, if that's a provocation, so be it. You know, that's the, you know, the level and tenor of advice that has been fed into the highest levels of the British government. And Burnham is surrounded by people who you know, were receiving these briefings, you know, seemingly take what they were told very seriously. So yeah, you know, that's a problem, because Britain is now signed up to fighting a war it can't fight. The British public are almost unanimously opposed to direct military confrontation with Russia. There was a poll recently which indicated that just 6% of Britons would fight for their country if it was invaded, to say nothing of, you know, voluntarily signing up to be killed horribly by a drone.
6%?
Yes. Yes. Like, and funnily enough, you know, like, people like Paul Mason, we've reported on some leaked emails where he's discussing ways to get Gen Z interested in fighting Russia. And Paul Mason's prescriptions are, you know, all Muslim artillery units, and, you know, all women you know, units in military.
You're yanking my chain. You're not being real right now. He didn't say
this. No, this is serious. This is serious. Oh, this is deeply serious. And it's just like, and this is a point that we keep making on the show, is that, you know, this on our show, and it's important to reiterate, is that this stuff is on one level like completely farcical and hilarious, but they're going to try and do this anyway. And the British government is formally committed to trying to prepare the nation for war. And teaching average citizens about the value of rationing, you know, all this other stuff, which is just like completely, there's no appetite for it whatsoever. So that's one quagmire the British are very much mired in. And actually, I think they're so enmeshed in this senseless proxy war that they can't actually extricate themselves, and they know that. But also, like, you know, in the recent, you know, American Zionist conflict on Iran, it demonstrated how Britain, you know, Britain's irrelevance, you know, on the world stage, you know, in the modern day. So when this all kicked off, there was a lot of discussion about whether Britain should or could get involved. Keir Starmer was initially publicly, like, very committed to assisting the US in this. That was not only deeply unpopular, but also it ran the risk of British assets, you know, remaining assets, whether in West Asia or, you know, places like Cyprus, coming under attack. So Britain kind of backed off and is allowing its territory to be used in the war on Iran, but is not directly a belligerent in the conflict. But it's also raised all sorts of very awkward questions for Britain from an imperial perspective. So in Cyprus, for a very long time, and this is not something that average British people are particularly aware of, ever since World War II, basically, Cyprus, which used to be formerly a British colony in every way, it has been host to major British military and intelligence bases, which have played a significant role in the Gaza genocide and are used to spy on Hezbollah and other resistance elements within West Asia specifically. Now, when the initial phases of the war in Iran erupted, you know, Cyprus airspace got shut down. And a lot of locals who for a very long time have not wanted the British there got really angry about it and staged protests and started organizing and making a lot of noise about this. And it became an issue in mainstream Cypriot politics. Why the hell are the British here? And maybe we should be having a discussion about whether they should just leave, you know. So that's a major issue for Britain. But by the same token, you know, British power is still to a certain extent expanding. You know, I've written extensively about how HTS was installed in power in Syria with the heavy assistance of British intelligence, you know, dating back many, many years. The now former head of MI6, Richard Moore, openly admitted we've been assisting HTS you know, 4 years in advance of their seizure of power. And then now a very shadowy conflict resolution firm run by Jonathan Powell, who was Blair's chief of staff, it has an office in Syria's presidential palace and therefore a significant degree of influence over how the Syrian government operates. And when Assad fell, Starmer said this opens up opportunities for Britain in West Asia. Of course, he didn't refer to it as West Asia, but, you know, so these imperial ambitions, they die pretty hard. like they're still there despite everything, despite Britain's precipitous decline in terms of its relevance, in terms of its military clout, you know, in terms of its economic power. You know, these delusions die pretty hard. And I mean, it was not too long ago that we saw massive riots in occupied Ireland, you know, in Belfast, and the, you know, overarching impression that people I know who are both Catholic and Protestant in occupied Ireland have is that this was deliberately stirred up by the British to justify their ongoing occupation. And that's the kind of thing the British are very good at. They've been doing it for literally centuries. So, yeah, I don't think they are fully out of juice in terms of their ability to stir up trouble. But in terms of, yeah, like, representing, you know, a major global power, that's like so far gone and irrecoverable at this point that, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, we should recognize how weak the British state and all that implies is in the modern day, but they are still not to be underestimated. You know, I live in a region of the world, you know, the once in future Yugoslavia, where Britain does have a significant degree of local influence. It has been involved in infiltrating police forces and helping overthrow governments and train militaries and try and get countries into NATO, despite, you know, often significant local opposition to joining. So they're not fully spent just yet, and we should be vigilant.
No, thank you guys for that. That's really good. I think there's a lot of, in my head, when I think about the UK, the role of what the UK is in the modern sort of geopolitical West, whatever that is, like I've returned to this metaphor of like that the US and the UK, this special relationship is just like avuncular, that it's uncle and nephew, that it's a passing on of a baton. But truly though, is that there is no real precedence for something like this in human history in terms of the relationship between what is called like the UK, this British, which is the sort of, you know, the modern instantiation or kind of what's the leftovers of what used to be called the British Empire. But that geopolitical power has been largely transferred to the nephew, right? The US. The US is the leader of the Western Bloc. And leader implies, you know, constituents or whatever. But really, this is like a mafia, and the US is one of the henchmen of this US imperial mafia project. However, in that same breath, though, is that like when we say things like, okay, the US is prosecuting a proxy war on Russia through Ukraine, but the UK is doing the same thing through Ukraine, but the US is also doing the same thing to the UK that it's doing to the US, to the Ukraine, right? That proxy nature, right? Because the larger is reflected in, even if the US doesn't necessarily control, although there's a great book, I don't know if you guys have seen it, it's called Vassal State. It came out, I think, 2 years ago. I think the author is like Angus something. I can't remember the last name. Where it's a mostly economic book where it lays out very cleanly just the sort of the obviously sort of subservient role that British capital plays to American capital, and how the sovereign, anything that we can consider sovereignty of the UK, is a kind of joke when it comes to economics, and because there's more things at stake than just the British, those little islands right off the coast of Europe. There's way more now that the imperialists can't prioritize Britain's sort of shine in the world over more important things, which is like raw hard power. So I guess my question is like, how does this irrelevance to the Western imperialist project, because it's both relevant and irrelevant, right? That it's a important player, it's an important base. For instance, Diego Garcia, right? Before this war, most people hadn't heard of Diego Garcia. They thought it was a person, probably, but it's actually a very important island. And guess what? It belongs to the UK. It belongs, whatever that means. That like it's this island of colonial, old holdover of colonial control. That's a base, a military operation, but it's a staging ground, but also surveillance, God knows what else. But like, it seems to me though that Without the money coming from West Asia, without the Gulf states, which the UK was really important in setting up, right? Like the Trucial states or whatever, I'm pretty sure they were set up by the UK. It wasn't like an American project. I mean, American project was Saudi Arabia, but those countries, like what we call like those Gulf monarchies, were the UK midwife them. The UK was there. The UK protected them. Those used to be UK territories, the same way that the UK controlled Iranian oil. Right, those were UK products. And how you brought up Syria kit, and I appreciate you did that. The UK was in charge of that, but the UK also was in charge. I mean, people lay it at the American feet, but really it was a joint operation, the one in 53 in Mossadegh, right? Like that Operation Ajax or Project Ajax or whatever, Operation Ajax. Like British fingerprints are all over the modern world, right? However, that modern world, because of largely the actions of like the nephew, American, like the Yankee nephew, launching this insane war, which to my mind, I don't think they consulted the UK, or if they did, they might have said, okay, you're doing this now. Like this war was in very few people's interest, including the UK. So I'm curious now, how do you see the increasingly disastrous results of both of these proxy wars, that the one in Ukraine, which obviously has been going on much longer, but now this one in West Asia, which to my view has accelerated American irrelevance. So if America's power is irrelevant in West Asia, what does that say about the great UK?
Well, shall I go first? Turning to the Ukraine war first, because that's something that the British political establishment is entirely unified in terms of their support for the continuation of this war. They cannot allow peace to break out there. They cannot allow this to end, even if this means that the great majority of the Ukrainian male population is sacrificed by the hundreds and hundreds of thousands in the battlefields of what was East Ukraine, because to admit or to allow peace to occur, to lose that project, which the British ruling class has spent arguably 35 years, arguably longer, building their networks there, building, carefully cultivating the networks of fascist organizations and other repositories of British power. To lose that would be devastating, because the project is all about, as is made clear from both declassified American documents and things that British government ministers and British government advisors have said, which is that if they can break up or cause the disintegration of Russia, or at least restore it to being run by like a Yeltsin type figure, though maybe they prefer one that was slightly less drunk, they can, if essentially like bail, they hope bail themselves out of the hole that they're in by asset stripping Russia for its resources, for its natural resources, for its land, for its the labor that can be exploited there. All of that is required to re-energize this totally corroded, dying British imperialism, which is solely dependent now upon the City of London's ability to move money anywhere in the world, exploit resources and people anywhere in the world, and funnel the proceeds back into the City of London again. So Britain is a very advanced case of like totally decayed imperialism. It's all the symptoms that Lenin talked about in Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, come to a terminal stage now. So they're desperate for the Ukraine war to continue. They're desperate for something to happen to deliver them the destabilization of the Putin system and the reimposition of Comprador rule there. It probably won't happen, but they can't stop, basically. They can't allow it to stop. I would also add that neither can the French and neither can the Germans. They're all completely committed to this now, because what's been in a crisis, what's revealed is the essence of all things. So the essence of, like, not just Britain, but the major European powers is now that they're all dependent upon the United States for the muscle, that none of them can really carry out acts of imperialism just purely on their own anymore. They need the unified bloc to actually act with them. So, for instance, look at the way that the Burkinabes and the Malians and the Nigerians chased the French out of what was once French West Africa. Basically said, right, time's up, get out. And the French tried all these different maneuvers. None of them have worked. They need the US, because without the US and all of its still more considerable military power than this bunch of European Euro losers, nothing is possible. So whether or not they think to move to the Iran war, a lot of the Europeans don't think the Iran war was the right move. A lot of them had more faith in the sort of JCPOA route, which was trying to cultivate internal Iranian compradors via building that financial linkage to European and British capital and trying to corrode the Islamic from within, basically. That was the tactics that I think were favored by the Europeans. But they don't get a choice, because the US reached a point in its in the evolution of its hostility, its 48-year-long hybrid war against Iran, where it had basically painted itself into a corner. Now, the Democrats will try and blame this all on Trump. Ah, oh, Trump, you know, he's crazy. He did this, that, and the other. But no, it's the logical outcome of 48 years of trying to destroy the Islamic Republic and the legacy of, like, sovereignty and independent development that the revolution in Iran established. And they had no move left. The color revolutions had all failed. But also they convinced themselves that if they just assassinated the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, that the whole system would collapse, only to for that calculation to be revealed to be disastrously wrong. So the US has got itself involved in a war which it can't win. Me and Kit have talked about this a lot. It can't invade Iran. If it did, it would suffer a defeat that would make the defeat in Vietnam look like a picnic by comparison. Its tactics have been revealed to be completely useless against an opponent that can shoot back. Like, the last 30 years of US so-called military dominance have all been based on the campaign they waged against Saddam Hussein in 1991, where Saddam obligingly allowed them to assemble an 800,000 strong army and didn't shoot at them for 3 months. And that's their model, where basically their opponent is too compromised or too weak to fight back. As soon as they get to a point where their opponent has, in terms of Iran's air defense capacity and missile capacity, the ability to hurt them, the whole thing just falls to pieces. Because again, to go back to the point about decayed imperial powers, the US is still more powerful than the Europeans or the British, but it's decayed nonetheless. It can't, even though it's desperately trying to recruit an army again now, it still can't field an army that's capable of invading a nation like Iran. It can't take on the Russians either, never mind the Chinese. So they just keep doing the same thing over and over again and failing.
Pause for a second, guys. Here, I just have to wait for a second. I have to say bye.
Feel like I should play the guitar or something.
Or just start juggling, intermission.
I could sing Flower of Scotland. That'd annoy all the right people.
Sorry about that. Kit, what do you think?
That's okay.
What do you think the... go ahead. If you want to finish, I don't know if you're finished.
I was just going to say I'll hand over to Kit now.
Yeah, sure. So, no, thank you for that, guys. Like, I was going to say, in the spirit of shameless plugs, I just wrote something for my website. It's titled "How Britain Exploits U.S. Empire." Now, for a very long time, for the best part of a decade, I have been, particularly since the Ukraine proxy wars eruption, I have been arguing publicly and trying to offer citations in support of the view that Britain, exploits the US empire via a combination of schmoozing, but also straight up manipulation. And by starting fires the world over and then getting the US to extinguish them or pour more petrol on the blaze, depending on British interests in a particular context. And in the Ukraine context, I have had quite a lot of pushback for suggesting that Britain is actually ultimately steering this, not the US and the CIA. But I came into possession of some leaks which spelled this out in black and white, very plainly. They're written by this a figure who crops up quite a lot in our show called Chris Donnelly, who's a longstanding British Ministry of Defence advisor, this deranged, Russophobic, cold warrior hawk. Was in charge of NATO expansion in the 1990s and was at the forefront of getting countries in the former Warsaw Pact and Soviet Union and Yugoslavia to join NATO again, often in the face of significant, if not overwhelming, public opposition in these countries. And since then, he has been attempting to trigger war with Russia using Ukraine, as a beachhead, and has been heavily embedded with hardcore ultranationalists from the Baltics and Ukraine itself to achieve this objective. And so in these leaks, Donnelly basically describes how Britain's kind of underpinning objective for a very long time has been ensuring that US interest, quote unquote, remains focused on Europe and West Asia, which are Britain and Europe's traditional stomping grounds, in every way, and regions that Britain has historically sought to dominate and control. Donnelly talks at length about how this is effectively an ongoing barter agreement between the US and Britain, and Britain can offer Britain will profit if it can offer things that the US can't do itself. There are various fields, including counterinsurgency, where Britain has historically said, "Well, we're experts at this because of our experience, from running the empire or in occupied Ireland. That's why we should be involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we should be guiding your thinking on the war on terror, etc." It's all spelled out very, very, very neatly, and Donnelly makes a number of very, very revealing remarks about how the Ukraine and Syria conflicts have reawakened US interest in Europe and West Asia, and of course, and this is written before the proxy war started, which is something to reflect on perhaps. And also Donnelly talks about how the US must, in order to keep them in Europe, must see a return on its enormous investment in NATO. So we've just had a NATO summit which began with Trump having made all sorts of vicious condemnations of European countries for failing to get involved in Iran, and talking about forcibly annexing Greenland and threatening to withdraw US forces from countries like Germany. And then Trump leaves boasting of the love and unity of NATO and all of the money that the US arms manufacturers are going to make from selling weapons to Ukraine and Europe as a result of Europe's commitment to keeping the war going and reinvesting in their militaries. What the relationship in a large sense boils down to. But I think as well, one of the reasons that Britain is in crisis is that US imperialism provides a beachhead, not only for British, but also French and particularly German now, imperialism all over the world. So, you mentioned how Britain was involved in the creation of the the Gulf states. They set up the various monarchies that have dominated these countries in inverted commas for the most part for a very long time. But also in places like Jordan, Jordan is ruled by a British created throne. Its king is a British army veteran himself. Jordan was basically carved out of West Asia under Sykes-Picot. Now, of course, the US is the primary military power within West Asia, and it has bases in Jordan. But that military occupation allows the British to worm its way into different sectors of the Jordanian state. And it's something that I've written about. GCHQ veterans give training to Jordan's repressive security apparatus in dark arts and hacking into people's phones and, you know, et cetera. This is a country where you can go to prison for social media posts which are critical of the ruling monarchy. The Gaza genocide is posted.
Wait, you're talking about the UK or Jordan?
This power has been used to crack down on Palestinian solidarity within Jordan, which is almost unanimous. And of course, a significant proportion of Jordan's population are Palestinian. They are often descended from people who fled Palestine in the Nakba, or are, refugees of the Nakba themselves. It's a basically unsustainable state. When the Americans leave, and I think that they could potentially leave very abruptly, well, that's a beachhead that Britain can no longer exploit because they don't have the muscle to stay there. Indeed, you could make an argument that the Jordanian state will just collapse in the manner of Afghanistan, actually, like when the Americans leave. So there is an ongoing British battle to keep the Americans there. And again, this is not restricted just to West Asia. We look nearby to me, Bosnia. The US since 1995 has heavily occupied that country, not only militarily, but economically and in terms of civil society. Most basic functions of government and the state are outsourced to US funded NGOs, the US has it's a basically unsustainable US protectorate that's been created in Bosnia since 1995. The US has indicated that they are planning to leave Bosnia at some point in the near future. This was always the plan. In fact, they were initially only intending to stay in Bosnia for a few years. They certainly weren't expecting to still be there today. And so again, when the US leaves, well, Britain, which has infiltrated the Bosnia's security and intelligence services, and their military, the British have signed all sorts of agreements with the Bosnian government. Well, the Brits are going to have to skedaddle when that happens. And, I mentioned Afghanistan. I remember very well the scale of the US withdrawal caught every British pundit, and indeed it seems the British government, completely off guard. And there were British ministers who, on the day that all of this crazy footage of Kabul airport of people falling out of planes that they've just been clinging on to try and escape, was circulating on the on social media, there were British ministers who were saying, well, maybe we could stay there under a new British-led international coalition. That lasted about a day before the British realized this was insane and ran away with a tail between their legs. There are all manner of places in the world, including actually parts of Latin America, where Britain is effectively exploiting and benefiting from US hegemony. When that hegemony is gone, and maybe in Latin America that wouldn't be necessarily, we wouldn't have a last chopper out of Saigon style seen anywhere there, but in other parts of the world, I don't think that's particularly unrealistic. In terms of something that could happen very abruptly, in the very near future, the US is increasingly refocusing on Asia. It's increasingly refocusing on its quote unquote backyard. So, given that British influence and presence in so many different regions and territories within the world is entirely contingent on US occupation, of course the British are going to be doing everything, including all sorts of skullduggery, to keep the Americans there. And again, I think this is what kind of makes the British, somewhat dangerous, because as impotent in many ways as they are, and much reduced in every way, because it's not beyond the British to pull off a false flag or, you know, I mean, the Syrian conflict was typified by British intelligence staged chemical weapons attacks, which were, you know, intended to be blamed on Assad and therefore draw the Americans in and trigger air wars or, you know, outright invasion. You know, that was what the British were doing, and actually being very open and honest about their objective to keep the Americans involved there. So that does create a risk, and I think it's something that more people should be paying attention to. And, you know, even in their reduced capacity for skullduggery and conniving and all sorts of, you know, cloak and dagger activities, the British do still have a global influence. Like the basis of the aforementioned JCPOA, this notion that Iran was seeking nuclear weapons, and this was something that was signed off by the IAEA, leading to your international sanctions against Iran. Its basis was an MI6 black propaganda campaign. In the spirit of, you know, Iraqi WMD, MI6 took the lead in sourcing supposed intelligence on Iran's nuclear capabilities, and then was responsible for infiltrating the IAEA to get the organization behind this idea. To an extent remains the rationale for the ongoing conflict with the American Zionist conflict with Iran, is that we're attempting to prevent Iran from enriching its uranium and acquiring nuclear weapons. Well, they never intended to in the first place. It was a British intelligence disseminated lie. Although I think that the resultant conflict has probably pushed the Islamic Republic closer to acquiring them than ever before.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about wins and losses lately, like the idea of, like, you know, geopolitics and, you know, kind of being these never ending kind of battles or whatever games between different actors, right? Where one side is a winner, one side's a loser. Sure, sometimes it's like a stalemate, but overall, I think I was able to sort of determine or like think about like a bunch of wins that like the sort of Western empires, including the UK, have sort of accrued in my lifetime, right? So Kit, you live in one such country that can count as a win. This is, of course, to be a sociopathic imperialist, so this is not to actually say it's a win, but it's a win for them, right? To smash an independent, large, resource-rich coastal country with a diverse population who have been one of the sort of stalwart forces of Euro-communism, or not the European communism, not Euro-communism, that means something else, but that, like, to smash that is a clear win. And to inflict that in such a way that doesn't result in any serious casualties on your own land, even better. That's the ideal. And this is the kind of empire, or these are the kind of wars that the British Empire is used to having, right? Because the Brits had this amazing way of doing things. For 400 years, 500 years, they sailed around the planet, killed people, destroyed people, stole stuff, and then they would go home, or they would stay, and then send profits home and resources home. And until World War I, basically, I'm pretty sure, or even World War II, until like the V2 rockets start showing up in London, suddenly, you know, you need them. And actually, they needed the Yankee help, right? Like, they needed the Yankee intervention to save their asses. So it's been a long time. It's been apparent to me that the UK is able to wage wars abroad and destroy countries. But actually getting yourself mixed up in real, honest to God, like, conflicts, geopolitical wars between peer actors or between countries that aren't impoverished, like, that's something that imperialists don't want. And in a lot of ways, this nightmare Iran scenario was them refusing to actually pay the bill for the meal they wanted to have, which is to say, they wanted to, like, be able to drink, like, wine out of, like, the skulls of Iranian leadership. Like, that's what they wanted. Right? Like, they wanted to see their puppets, like you brought up Yeltsin, right? Like, every interview with Yeltsin was them spiking the football, because they got to show Russians, and at that time it was like the Russian Federation, that look, we destroyed your empire that used to be threatening us, or we destroyed the country that used to be, and look what we left in its place. This guy who is human brain damage, sentient brain damage, walking around, and he's destroying your country, selling off your assets. But then you think about, like, that looked like a win, right? Like in 1991, I always think of GoldenEye. I'm sure you guys know it. Like, GoldenEye was their way of being like, look what we did. Like, that's them. Like, they probably did espionage while they were filming GoldenEye. Like, they were probably used GoldenEye as an excuse to do more damage to, like, that Russian Federation. So, like, that to me is, like, peak hubris of them saying, like, look what we can do to you. But remember what happens in 1999. Literally at the end of 1999, at the end of the millennium, Boris Yeltsin walks into a room and he finds Vladimir Putin sitting there, and Vladimir Putin says, sign this, you drunk. And Vladimir Putin, and he records basically a message that I'm passing this off. This is a disaster what I've done. I'm passing this off. And that was 35 years ago or 25 years ago. Like, they still have a Vladimir Putin problem. Now imagine, now of course, there's a lot of things that happen in that interim that also included like the new Russian ruling class basically saying to the West, okay, we can work together, we can have some kind of you know, new arrangement where you don't have to necessarily, you know, strip our country, the suck the marrow out of our country, which is what you're doing now, but you have to, like, respect a bit of our sovereignty and we can be partners. But guess what they got in return? They got dirty wars in Georgia. Where else? Dirty wars in the Caucasus. Well, the Caucasus were before. Well, no, that was the Caucasus. What am I saying? It was over Georgia, and I forget the other one. What was the other one? South Ossetia is Georgia, and the other one is, I can't remember.
Abkhazia,
thank you. So, like, that's what they got. They started to lose. Like, all of a sudden, those wins, right? Those were wins in the 90s. Like, in the 80s and 90s, those were wins. They started to lose those wins. All of a sudden, you now have a situation where that country, especially the big one, the Russian Federation, is no longer, you can't just, like, suck marrow out of its bone. And now they start to defect. And, of course, the project in Donbass is a continuation of that, which is to say that they tried to turn Ukraine from what it had been, which was kind of neutral or a kind of actor that was a kind of in between the two regional forces, right? Between the sort of Western or the Eastern edge of Western power, right? Which is, you know, Yugoslavia, I guess, at that point, and Russia. Right. And they tried to nibble away because imperialists can't stop. They have one setting. It's called imperialism. So all of a sudden, though, the wins that they had enjoyed in starting in, say, I don't know what you want to say, but, like, let's say Ossetia or Abkhazia or whatever. All of a sudden, they look like a loss because they lost a chunk of land. Right. Abkhazia. We don't talk about Abkhazia. We don't talk about Georgia or Saakashvili or whatever. It's old news now because it didn't work out for the imperialists the way it was supposed to. But it actually backfired in some ways. And those lands leave and Georgia looks like a puppet state and those sovereignty goes and whatever. Right. But you think about, like, that now I'm thinking again in terms of, like, okay, so they won in Syria, right? They won in Jordan long ago. They won, right? They won in the West Bank, which we don't talk about, when they got Palestinian compradors with God knows whose help to kill their own leader and coup d'etat him and put a puppet in charge, which we don't name as a Palestinian coup d'etat, but it was. But these were wins. But the thing about imperial power, and this is my question to you guys, is that, like, they have to stack all these wins together and these wins have to work together, right? Because when you're like, it's almost like, I don't know, like, how carpentry you guys are, but, like, when you're cutting against the grain, like, to rule countries from afar, you're cutting against the grain, right? Like, you're working against something organic, which is human beings don't want to be controlled by external actors. They don't like it. It doesn't work out in their case, in most cases. It doesn't work out to their benefit because they know that, like, these actors have no, they don't live here with us. They're not one of us. They're here for what we have. So arranging that takes immense amount of work, to arrange a situation where, you know, you destroy a country as big as Yugoslavia, and then you have to work to keep vassals in charge who keep to do your bidding, even though life quality keeps going down and down, which I'm presuming is happening. I mean, I'm looking, the sort of, what I know, the little that I know about the actual quality of life issues in the Balkans has to do with electricity rates. One time I saw like a a map of electricity rates and like how much you pay per capita or per kilowatt hour. And guess what? The country that got smashed by the West, turns out they don't have a lot of power generation. Like turns out that their infrastructure costs them a lot more to run now, or doesn't have enough of it, or they're getting super exploited. I mean, I don't know the exact details, but you see that the resulting shattered country that in microstates that they created, it's to the benefit. It's not to the benefit of the people, not in any way. That it may be to a benefit of a few of the ruling class, and anyways, they send their kids west and they leave and they tell everyone, oh, it's great there, whatever. But that was a win. But now I'm thinking they won in Ukraine too when they got Poroshenko, when they got that guy out, Poroshenko. No, who's the guy that they coup d'etat?
Yanukovych.
And then they put their puppet in charge. That was like 2014 or something, or maybe before. Yes. That was a win, right? Like they got their win. The guy was about to turn to Russia for cheap loans because sovereign countries like cheap loans. Or even if they're pseudo-sovereign. And it turns out that you're not allowed to do that. You broke the rules. So they got rid of him. And, you know, he was an inch away from being killed. And Russians got him out. There's like a whole documentary. He's escaped on a helicopter. Like, that's... they wanted the fate of Libya for Ukraine, right? In the sense that a complete humiliation. But then it wasn't enough that they smashed Ukraine and took it over, that they took it away from Russia, which I don't even think is actually true designation, because in a large extent, it was mostly neutral. Like it was because from my understanding, at least within Ukraine, you do have itself a problem of one part of the country be leaning more west and another part of the country leaning more east. I mean, maybe that's like a simplification, but it's so they exploit these problems that are intrinsic to countries, use them to their benefit, remove any vestiges of sovereignty, and then get them to do their bidding. And in the case of Ukraine, I mean, that is the, in my mind, when I think about the disasters that await countries at the hands of imperialism, I think of Ukraine. Like, I actually think of Ukraine because they smashed this country. They smashed the biggest, like one of the biggest, if not the biggest country in that region that had immense amount of infrastructure left over from the Soviet Union, that had coastal land, that had this amazing resource called Crimea, that had like diversity, that had people who spoke different languages, who lived together, who made a life together. These are things that make a country strong. And so the U.S. takes these things, the imperialists take these things from you, and then they proceed to destroy what you have left. I mean, that to me, like the tragedy of what happened to generations now of Ukrainian men, mostly. And God knows, and not to just say men, I mean, God knows where women are going, probably being trafficked and God knows where. Like, this is not, this, what happened to Ukraine is evil. And I live in Canada. It got sold to me as like a love fest. That it got sold to me as like, you know, finding your inner Zelensky books at local bookstores. Like this is evil what the U.S. did to Ukraine. And we hear it's sold to us here as like, oh, wave your flag. Like Ukrainians here will boost this. Of course, they're fascist Ukrainians or liberal Ukrainians, but they'll tell you this like, oh, you know, Russia's evil, whatever, Zed, Nazis, blah, blah, blah. They spell Russia with two Zeds or whatever, like that bullshit. But in the meantime, like their country lost sovereignty. Their country lost potentially millions of people, not just in deaths, but in emigration. They lost all this capital. I mean, literally, like, I don't know. This is also another thing that, I mean, this opens up a whole other can of worms. But obviously, I follow a lot of Russian Telegram channels. And you see these videos from Ukraine of like dudes, and it's not just like Russians, like this is happening, it's not just Ukrainians, it's happening to Russians too, but dudes being hunted down by drones. Just like a human life ending with a buzzing sound, like on camera, and then they release the footage, they play that horrible metal music, like both sides do this. I will be real, both sides do this, and it's a horrible specter of what's to come for the future of conflict. Like, there's no bottom to the end of this pit of despair when it comes to Ukraine. And last night was another one. So I just think, like, my question is, like, why, what is it about Westoid life? And this is a question I ask myself, but you guys are closer to these wars geographically, so you would presume that people would be, like, more uprising around them. But what is it about Westoid life that makes these crimes invisible to them? Is it just the media gives people an excuse to not look deeper? Is it really that stupid? Or is it like, well, they benefit from these wars? Because I can't see a benefit to the UK invading Russia or even this war in the Ukraine. Like, I'm having a hard time seeing the benefit of a Nord Stream attack on the future of Europe. It certainly wasn't in the interest of the German capitalists for them to blow up Nord Stream, right? But because the US is like a geopolitical pyromaniac, that it does these things. So my question is, like, why are these populations so neutered? Why don't they do something? I mean, obviously they criminalize any amount of dissent, but life is like the, like, British life, from what I can tell, like, is you're pretty snookered there in terms of the future, right? Climate change, energy resources, like infrastructure, these are all things that are trending downwards. And people don't resist. People don't rise up. Like, what is it? What magic formula have our ruling classes in the West discovered in us that makes this system work for them, where people don't resist?
Well, on the matter of resistance, I mean, one has to be fair and say that there was a larger degree of resistance when it came to the Palestine question. There was quite a lot of it about, in terms of demonstrations, in terms of direct action, which is why the repression was unleashed. So there was resistance when it came to that. And because there's been a longer history of, Palestine solidarity action across, like, the broad swathe of the British left going back 50, 60 years, perhaps longer. So there was on that question. The issue is, though, like, you ask, why is the population acquiescent over the Ukraine war? The answer is because not only is it the case that Ukraine war's consequences are hidden, largely. If you were to sit down and look at, like, you know, energy bills, food prices, the crises that spun off and out of the Ukraine war, you could see the consequences. But no one spells that out to the great majority of, like, the British population, just as they don't spell it out to the great majority of the American or the Canadian or the French population. So the British media just goes on its usual parade of, like, blaming waves of military-aged men invading the country via migration for everything. But, you know, more seriously, it's the fact that, and then here we can go back to the resistance and the demonstrations in favor of solidarity of the Palestinians. It's the fact that you have a political system that will not allow change, that openly gives you the middle finger, basically. And I experienced this 24 years ago, 25 years ago, in the build-up to the Iraq War, which is that in Britain, you are, whether you are on the left or whether you're just apolitical, you're trained in this idea of political engagement, which is you must go out on the streets, you must assemble at a certain point, you must march round the historic sites of London and go and assemble in Hyde Park, when you will hear from leftist luminaries and others about how they must pay attention to us. And of course, the system doesn't pay attention to you. In fact, it ignores you at best, or at worst, it arrests you for, you know, dissenting. And nobody has any alternative way forward, because British people, and the same is true in a lot of Western nations, you've been trained in this manner of, like, what is the acceptable way to do political action, which is essentially, taking the propagandistic sort of Gene Sharp model and trying to apply it inside the imperial court, because it doesn't work. Because the reason it works over in targeted nations like Ukraine is because you have a whole section of the elite which is already defected to the side of the imperialists. That doesn't exist here. You have complete ruling class unanimity behind aggression against Russia, aggression against Iran, aggression against the Palestinians or the Lebanese or whoever else dares to show any resistance to imperialism. And so if you're a person who's engaging in politics or trying to engage in the politics of resistance against war, you're left with nowhere to go, because the official movements And there's many decent people involved in the official Palestine Solidarity and Stop the War movements, but marching around London and waving a placard in the air does nothing. It doesn't. It annoys the ruling class a little bit, but that's about it. And then just bring in more laws to enable you to be arrested. And here's where I'll just expand it slightly and talk about like what this means in terms of the long-term problem. The long-term problem in Britain was that previously the way that the working class could actually make its presence felt was via the trade union movement, was via like staging walkouts. There was a long militant tradition which included internationalism. Like in the 70s, like workers in, I think, at least like one arms plant refused to handle an order for Pinochet's Chile. You used to get like the anti-apartheid movement was a serious thing in the trade union movement. You used to get like a lot of like walkouts based on like international solidarity issues. All of that got exterminated, basically. Trade union power got completely, not completely destroyed, but badly damaged after the early 1980s and the repression of the miners' strike and deindustrialization. So what we're left with is this like faded memory of like, of like democratic influence and the propaganda of our own ruling class, which says, be polite, turn up with a placard, march around, and maybe you'll get listened to, which just isn't true because, as I've already said, and as Kit's covered extensively, like power in Britain or any imperial core nation does not lie in the ridiculous goings on in Parliament. So why the hell are you bothering going and demonstrating outside of it? So the fact is you have a demoralized and beaten populations. You have populations that have tried things over the last 15 years. Like there was an attempt to revitalize trade union resistance that was sold out by the trade union leaders. There was an attempt at like in Scotland where I live, there was the attempt at Scottish independence, which was stitched up by the state, arguably like rigged on the day itself, the referendum itself, and then sold out ultimately by who? By the Scottish National Party leaders who are completely in hock to Westminster. You have like the Labour Party and under Jeremy Corbyn, again, crumbled under establishment pressure. My point here is that people have tried various things. It's all been crushed by the establishment. It's all been crushed by the power of the political establishment, the security services, and behind them, the financial power of the City of London. So you need fundamentally there needs to be a recalibration of like, what is resistance? Because it's not marching around the capital city anymore, politely asking to be paid attention to. Because the people you're asking for their attention, they don't have the power to do anything anyway. So this is the problem in all the imperial nations. We've been sold this idea of like democratic participation means voting or means politely asking or something like that, or pressuring the system in some way. Doesn't work when the systems run from these networks, which are immune to pressure. So we need to fundamentally recalculate the way that this resistance is done, because the days of politely asking and, you know, signing petitions, etc., this is a mug's game. It's led to absolutely nothing. Only the people who get involved in that just end up demoralized. So new tactics are required. I think one of the ways we've got to do it is basically we have to move beyond the politics of like the middle class polite activist layer and go back to actually mobilizing ordinary people, not only in defense of their interests, but on the basis of genuine internationalism now. This is the way, only way it's going to work. And that, of course, means a collision with the forces of the state. And to successfully do that, you need to understand the forces of the state. And due to the influence of like rotten British social democracy, the forces which has spent 100 years mystifying the British state and pretending they can reform it, again, too many people don't understand what the British state is for and what it's like. So we need education. We need to do resistance in a better way and a more organized way. But I'll throw it to Kit now for his opinions on the matter.
Yeah, sure. So I think I actually beat you to the punch there. So it's actually a game that I set up to win. I think that absolutely echo what Alex just said. Is I think the education point is really, really, really important, because I mean Britain is the original home of like anti-communism and was very central to the promotion of the compatible leftism via intelligence operations like Information Research Department, which promoted the works of George Orwell and other anti-communist supposed left writers. And I think that's left an enduring legacy in terms of political imaginations, including on the within the British left itself. I know a great many people in the UK who identify as radical who do not have remotely radical politics. In fact, they have highly counter-revolutionary politics and believe all sorts of rubbish about China, which would you would think disqualify them from radical politics at all. But I think that there needs to be an education both in terms of Britain's actual past experiences with working class organizing, with struggle, but also call them ideological experiments elsewhere in the world. And that's something that we think is very important to do at Decline and Fall. We've done specials on communist Albania, which is commonly regarded as this nightmarish totalitarian backwards hellhole. Shock horror, it actually wasn't. And other political systems. I'm often reminded of it. Owen Jones wrote this absolutely appalling book called The Establishment back in 2015, and it was meant to be a kind of takedown of how the British establishment gets away with it. But it's full of all sorts of blind spots, not least because Owen Jones was at that time a very prominent Guardian journalist and a graduate of elite universities, and therefore part of the very establishment that he was seeking to skewer. And many reviews of the book were in the mainstream media were written by people who went to university with him, interestingly. But there is a very interesting excerpt in it where he talks to a Conservative MP. I'm not sure if they're named or not, but he says that Margaret Thatcher's greatest achievement was reducing elections to a few to arguments over a few million in tax receipts. Like the politics stopped having any meaning from Thatcher onwards, and the destruction of the trade unions led to the destruction of radicalism amongst the working class and all sorts of structures, including working men's clubs or social areas where workers could sit around and talk about revolutionary ideas. This all got eradicated completely, and the UK is very depoliticized. There remains, as Alex says, I think a deeply problematic belief that political action is maybe turning up to the occasional milquetoast protest, which doesn't really do anything apart from maybe make a little bit of noise, and voting. And I've seen what I believe to be a quite troubling development in terms of a large number of people pinning all their hopes on the Green Party, as if they're going to save Britain from itself and whatnot. I think pinning your hopes on any political party in that manner is wrong-headed for provable, demonstrable historical reasons. But also, the Greens remain in many ways tied up to all sorts of elite established imperial structures, including NATO. Like, they still stand on a platform of being part of NATO, in common with most Green parties in the Western world. So it's like, I think that imaginations need to be expanded. I think that it's actually very important to, and this is, this kind of feeds in more into my journalism, but it's what we also seek to tackle in Decline and Fall, is the basic reality of the British state, particularly its covert elements, because people don't know. It's not because they're stupid or necessarily ignorant. They're just not told about what Britain is doing in the, or has done in the world historically, or indeed what Britain is doing now. And I'm frequently reminded of, there's a quote in Lloyd George, who was the British Prime Minister during World War One, he and was also subsequently an admirer of Hitler, it must be stated. He remarked that if people knew the reality of the front line in the war, that it would end tomorrow. And I think that applies to so much the British state is doing domestically, overseas, etc. People actually really knew about this in a, and enough of them did, then there would be wider movements to oppose this stuff. But people have been, you know, robbed of that knowledge and that, you know, source of anger and, you know, desire for change. But they've also been robbed of the knowledge of how to achieve that change as well. And I think that's, you know, it's a very important thing to do. Look at what has worked elsewhere in the world. Look at the, you know, Britain's past, you know, revolutionary and radical achievements. Learn from mistakes, be honest about shortcomings, but also, you know, embrace the successes, really. I think it's, you know, a very important thing to do. And one of the things that I hear a lot from friends of mine, whether they're, you know, communists or otherwise, who are engaged in, you know, righteous radical struggles, you know, in the global south, or, you know, kind of more, you know, modern Anglo-American colonies, is that there is a lack of knowledge about the successes of past revolutions. You know, that's a very key thing that crops up over and again. So, I think there needs to be a lot more education about that. Absolutely, and that's something that we're committed to doing. I think in your own way, you're committed to doing too. Hence why you have us on again.
That's great. I think I agree with you guys. I guess it's an hour and 15 in. I'm conscious of your time. I want to say this. You had a great title for this episode, Kit, The Revenge of History. That's I think that's a perfect way to think about what's the future of what's gonna, like, sort of like how the future will unfold, because there is a lot of violence on the hands of the British Empire, an immense web of sorrow. Just like, it's just the scale of it is so incredible. To think just India alone, how many human beings perished in that one country. I mean, mind you, it's a subcontinent, it's a large country, but just there alone, forget what's called North America now, forget, you know, wherever else, like that, just to think of the scale of the human costs of what happened in India, how the whole country was looted. And now I'm thinking now that are the people, and you guys are both from this country, you guys are both products of this country, even if, you know, you're sort of outside of it in ways, like, even, do you think people are ready for the future that awaits the UK, which is like more decline? Like, it's more of, it's like your podcast name, it's a decline and fall. And really, it's like a fall and an ever, never ending decline. Because ultimately, the nature of the power that the Brits, like, built their world upon, that's gone. Like, they can't close. They enjoyed a technological gap between them and the people they fought. They exploited that gap, right? Technical, financial, whatever. They used those, but those gaps are gone. Like, China is far more advanced than the UK. It's far more modern. Russia is far more modern than the UK. You go to the UK, it's like New York City, man. This is the corpse of the 18th and 19th centuries lurching forward. The industrial corpse, which is to say, when labor was cheap, where you could just throw like Irish people at a ditch and tell them to dig and they could die and it didn't matter. So I'm wondering, from both of your perspectives, the decline will get uglier, especially with climate change and energy crises. Like, the modern world lives on cheap energy. That cheap energy is gone. And the UK doesn't have its own. I mean, I guess it has Scottish oil fields, right? Or whatever, in the sea. But like, does it have the capacity to, say, begin solar generation? Does it have the political stomach to do that? It would have to go to China to buy those panels, by the way. And not exactly, being a US vassal doesn't exactly allow you to go and rely on China, right? Canadians are going to learn that sooner or later, right? So this is a question that Canadians will have to deal with too, that as the Western bloc gets more and more irrelevant, right? And this Iran war has accelerated that. Personally, how do you think your peoples will react? They'll deny it? Do you think they'll say, no, this, we're not going to accept this? Or will they turn on the ruling class? Or will it be both? Will it just be, as at the beginning, people will say, oh, okay, whatever, we'll just deal with it. But over time, will they will turn on the ruling class or what? I mean, the Palestine Action people, as you brought up, Alex, earlier, like they are truly heroic actions. They are now facing, like those people are facing immense amount of jail time and God knows what else in the future, right? That, so I'm curious though, like is the stomach, are people ready for the decline or is it just head in the sand, we'll take what will comes, keep calm, carry on?
Oh, it really depends which part of like the not so United Kingdom you're looking at, because there's several different components to it. The fact that you have now consistent support for both Scottish independence and Welsh independence makes a difference. Like the fact that you are now have like a Republican majority in the occupied six counties of Ireland makes a difference. So the likelihood is that as the crisis intensifies and as the British government tries to assert its control more in increasingly repressive ways, that's only going to strengthen national feeling in Scotland, Wales and Ireland for a start, which means that the northern and western parts of this thing called the United Kingdom eventually, probably within about, without wanting to put too firm a timeline on it, 15 to 20 years, are probably going to go their own way, one way or the other. Now, the important thing is that we can't let it be the case. They go their own way and led by the leaders at the moment who want to commit to the EU, NATO, and everything else that comes with it. But the point is that that will shatter like the British power, which is like the breaking up of that, of Britain itself, which I argue every anti-imperialist in the world should support the dismantling of this foul, murderous entity, which has spent 400 years rampaging and around the world, stealing everything that's not nailed down and killing as it goes. So there is that. There's the national aspect to it. The other aspect to it is that, like in the working class, not just in Scotland or Wales, but across the country or all of the nations that make up Britain, they're already in a crisis. Their living standards have already gone to shit. Now, where the furious denial exists is in the bits of the middle class, the petty bourgeoisie, who are still wealthy enough to be in a state of denial, who still have, you know, 2, 3, 4 properties and that they're deriving income from and a share portfolio. But that's a diminishing number of people. So they're mainly based in a few tiny islands of wealth in certain cities. So but those are the people who are in charge of like the major institutions. Those are the people who have the cultural influence, so to speak. So the change will depend upon whether a working class politics can be rebuilt or not, because the way they're trying to push it at the moment is they're trying to do two things. They're actively encouraging every chance they get, like racial tensions. They're encouraging open racist movements on the one hand, and then trying to like rally like liberal opinion behind the state on the other. So the way that the British ruling class will deal with this is the way that they've dealt with every crisis facing them over the last 100 years, which is try and divide the population into by religion, by race. Only now that'll be done directly inside the imperial core itself. So that's the way they're going to react. And we know that because they're doing it already and have been doing it for years. This is how they held on to the north of Ireland for 100 years after partition, etc. So you've got to be ready for the move they're going to make. And the only way around that is to like fracture this entity called Britain on national lines, and then be prepared to essentially resist on a class basis attempts to like pull the successor countries into like the NATO or EU alliances, and to refuse to play the game of the ruling class with regard to like religious or racist divisions, because that's the game that they're playing at the moment. But it's going to be a tough ask, because it's been over a generation since the last serious like class-based resistance was carried on, and like the only forces making the running in England at the moment are the forces of racism that are promoted by the ruling class. So it's going to be a hard thing to actually overcome this, but it can be done. Like the power of the British state now has never been as weak as it is now. Its forces of repression have dwindled away. It can still create a lot of chaos, but in terms of actual physical force, it doesn't have anything like the capability of repression it used to. So despite everything, I am hopeful that the beast can finally have a stake driven through its heart right in its lair.
Well, I mean, you know, my own strategy for collapsing the British state was one of us needed to get an OBE, and when we're being given it, just to, you know, like shoot the king or something. And I'm sure
he's kidding. YouTube, he's kidding. He's not calling for the assassination. It's allegedly metaphor.
Yeah, figuratively speaking, that's my in all seriousness, yeah, I mean, I remain optimistic because there are so many parallels with, you know, Britain's position now. I mean, obviously, like the various contexts and, you know, the kind of level of degradation endured by people is, you know, very different. But it's like, I mean, we look at what happened in Gaza on October 7th. You know, this was, you know, a visceral fight back from a, you know, much oppressed people. And you literally cannot just inflict such, you know, misery and destruction and deprivation on people without them getting angry and without that having, you know, very severe consequences. And I think that, you know, I mean, in many ways, like, you know, for a lot of average Britons, they are kind of edging towards, you know, a revolutionary mindset. They might not know it, and they might not have necessarily the ideological or, you know, historical grounding to, you know how to, you know, parlay that into something coherent and, you know, something decisive. But yeah, like, the British state is absolutely, you know, it has never been weaker in my lifetime. It is declining at an absolutely precipitous rate. I think that independence of, you know, Scotland and Wales would go a long way, even if they were led by these, you know, pro-NATO compradors, as you know, in some cases the devolved parts of the UK are now. Like, just the precedent that they could break away and run their own affairs in their own interests outside of Westminster's purview. I think, you know, that would be an inspiring message, and, you know, offer, you know, many practical lessons to others in how to upend, you know, the balance of power. Because yeah, I mean, this stuff is completely unsustainable. I frequently, you know, if you look at, like, you know, economic data, people's way for the overwhelming majority of people in Britain, their wages have been compressed with ever greater alacrity since the financial crisis. Living standards are not improving. The cost of everything is spiraling completely out of control. This is a fecund environment for a revolution to happen. And I just hope that, you know, more people look beyond the Green Party, say, as a means of achieving that.
Kit, Alex, it's always a pleasure. The show is Decline and Fall. Kit, I know you have a Substack. Alex, do you have a Substack?
Yes, I run one called Red Star Daily. Features like my own videos and articles. So for everybody, if you want more from me, go and check that out.
Okay. Well, thank you both, guys. We have to do this more often. Kit, Alex, I thank you. It's always fun to talk, and we'll talk soon. This is The Revenge of History. I like that title. Now, if I can only figure out how to press stop. How do I press stop?
I think you should keep this bit in. Keep this bit in.
Yeah, I will.
Like, you know, it's very improvisational. Like, I mean, on the subject of you know, placing your faith in impotent institutions, I've just seen an essay circulating, which was published by the Freedom Foundation, which asks the eternal question: will the CIA assassinate the democratic socialists? I'm sure that Hassan Piker is in the crosshairs, you know, as we speak, and, you know, blah blah.
we should probably end this before it goes even worse. Thanks, guys. Yeah. I appreciate it. Stay on the call.